MechCast, Sunday, December 20th, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode of Mac Apple news, information, tips, tricks, all that goings on in our Apple MechCast community. How you doing? I am doing pretty good. We're reaching the end of the year, getting close to Christmas. Right around the corner, just a couple days away. So hopefully, if you celebrate that, you're excited about that. Hopefully, you're just excited about the holiday season and coming to the close of a very strange, very rough year, I think. 2020 was a little off, but hopefully, you being able to hang out with me here in the MacCast community has brought a little extra fun, joy, maybe made it a little bit easier to get through. I know some of you have emailed me to say that it has, so I very much appreciate that, and I was glad to be a part and able to add a little bit of normalcy, hopefully, through the MacCast to 2020 with all the other weird stuff going on. And you might be thinking, hey, things could be winding down in terms of Apple news as we get toward the end of the year. It really hasn't. We have a lot of stuff to talk about looking at the show notes. I guess it's a little lighter than normal, but still plenty of stories to get into. We're going to talk about what's next for iPhone and iPhone displays specifically. I talk about Apple's new Fitness Plus service. We've got rumors of some new products that might be coming in 2021. Production of iPhones. We've got those new privacy app labels that we'll talk about a little bit. Also, follow up on some AirPods Max things, specifically reviews and just observations and additional information about the new AirPods Max, some map updates, and we're going to talk about some Apple retail store news as well. And that'll round out the news for this week, and then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I've got some follow-up on our conversation about using external drives for photo libraries and just some additional questions about external drives in general. We're going to talk about my NAS backup solution that I alluded to a little while back. Talked about my Mac Mini, my old Mac Mini, and how I repurposed that to be a storage server, a backup server. And I know I covered it a long, long time ago, but I did have some folks after I talked about that email me and say, hey, can you go into some more details on that? Because I'd love to repurpose one of my old Macs to do something similar. So I'll get into the details, the nitty-gritty, the software that I'm using for that, how I've set it up. It by no means is probably the best way, but it's the thing I do. So hopefully it'll give you some inspiration. And then we've got a follow-up on the voice memos thing from a listener. He had a great tip or bit of information to share with us, and then we'll round it out with one more thing of the moment. I got another new product in my life that I want to share with you that I'm pretty excited about and am enjoying. As a matter of fact, it's helping me record this podcast right now. So there's a little teaser for you, but it should be a good episode. So I say, let's dive right in. But before we do it, I do need to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Cashfly. We absolutely love Cashfly here at the MacCast. You may love Cashfly and not even know it, because the reality is without them, you would not be hearing this show right now. They provide the bandwidth. They provide the capacity to get these shows to you quickly and reliably, and they want to help you do something similar for your website and your business, because when websites don't load, people lose interest. As a matter of fact, for every second a page takes to load, it can cost a company up to 16% in engagement. And fewer visits to your website means fewer customers, and that is not good for anyone. Well, luckily, Cashfly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any additional development effort from you. And with the recent addition of Cachefly's flexible edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities go far beyond that of any traditional CDN. Cachefly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know that it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using. The good people at Cachefly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how Cachefly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Visit mac.cachefly.com. That's mac.cachefly.com. to get that Lighthouse score report and learn how Cachefly's web optimization solution can help you add 60 points instantly to your score. And a big thank you to Cachefly for their support of the MacCast. Care to guess what the latest rumors are saying is next for the iPhone Pro, the iPhone 13 Pro in 2021? Yep, L, it might be a rumor that we've heard before. They're saying that we're going to finally get a display with a 120 hertz refresh rate. This is according to latest rumors from the Korean website Elec. They say that Apple is going to use low temperature polycrystalline oxide, LTPO technology, in their OLED displays to finally bring ProMotion to the iPhone display. LTPO technology basically allows the backplane, which is the thing that turns individual pixels on and off for the display, to run more efficiently, letting it run at those higher refresh rates without suffering a battery life hit. So much more efficient on the battery levels. The site also claims that Apple could use the technology to bring an always-on display to the iPhone. That's because it also allows variable refresh rates, so they can set the refresh rate very, very low. And this is similar to the way they do it with the always-on functionality that's on the current Apple Watch. So some really cool new display technology possibly coming to the iPhone Pro in 2021. Kind of the first rumors we're hearing about the iPhone 13 Pro. I'm sure there's many, many more to come, but kind of the first ones leading into 2021. You may have noticed last week that Apple did launch on Monday their new Fitness Plus service. It was released along with some updates to watchOS and iOS, watchOS 7.2 and iOS 14.3. Those updates came out. Apple Fitness Plus, rather, is available to all Apple Watch users who subscribe to the Apple Fitness Plus service, and workouts can be done with an Apple Watch Series 3 or later, and it works with the iPhone, the iPad, and the Apple TV on the latest versions of the operating system. So you're going to need iOS 14.3 on your iPhone or iPad, and tvOS 14.3 on your Apple TV. And what the service offers is basically 10 different types of workouts across a range of durations. That includes high intensity interval training or HIIT training, strength, yoga, dance, core, cycling, treadmill for running or walking, along with rowing and mindful cool down workouts. It also integrates with Apple Music, and they have playlists that you can save off into the Apple Music app. So if you're doing a workout and you enjoy the music program in that workout, you can also save that as an Apple playlist that you can have over on Apple Music. So far, it looks like early reviews have been pretty positive about the new service. A lot of them kind of comparing it to something like a Peloton. Obviously, it's not at that same level. Apple doesn't provide the equipment, but overall, the service and the cost seems to be very competitive. The big comparison has been the quality of the trainers and just the programming in general, and it seems to be of that caliber, which isn't too surprising. That's what I would expect from Apple. You get to choose your workout in a bunch of different ways. They even have some filters where you can choose it by the type of workout you want to do, the duration, as low as like 10 minutes, which I think is pretty cool. So you don't have to make a big commitment to jump into Apple Fitness Plus. And then you can even sort by the type of music that you want to listen to, so the style of music, and you get various different instructors and those sorts of things. All of this is now accessed from a new tab that's in the fitness app once you update to the new operating system. So it's pretty easy to access. One thing that I liked when I was checking it out was that they had kind of a beginner's program. So if you haven't worked out in a while, you're kind of new to starting working out, they have a whole series that you can get into in each one of the different styles to kind of get you started. So I'm planning on trying out Fitness Plus. I haven't started yet, but once I do, I'll kind of give a little mini review maybe on a future episode of the MacCast, and I'll let you know how it's going, because I'd like to get more in shape. We used to have a gym membership, but with gyms being closed down, that just hasn't really worked out. So this might be a good viable alternative, and I'm definitely going to give it a try. I know some of you are also giving it a try, so if you have your own opinions and reviews and you want to send those into the MacCast, we would appreciate that. Audio comments are very welcome. Just ask that you keep them kind of brief, 2 to 3 minutes. Just give us your initial thoughts, opinions, let us know how it's working out for you, and we'd love to hear from you. So MacCast@gmail.com. But like I said, the reviews that are out in the media right now are pretty positive. I haven't seen too many critical comments, which is kind of nice for a new service from Apple. Now, there have been a few bumps in the road, and one of the biggest ones is that some Apple TV users have experienced an issue where their Apple Watches will give them a pairing canceled error when attempting to connect to the service. Apple says the issue, if you encounter this, is that the Apple TV has not been properly added to the Home app and HomeKit, so you can fix it by going into the Apple TV settings, going into AirPlay and HomeKit, and looking to see if you see a little red badge. If you do see that red badge, it means you have to finish the setup. So choose Finish Home Setup, then unlock your iPhone, hold it near your Apple TV, and then just follow the instructions on the Apple TV to add the Apple TV to the Home app. If you don't see the little red badge and you're still experiencing this problem, Apple advises that you contact Apple support. Few other interesting bits of information about the new Fitness Plus service. If you are a lifetime fitness gym member in the U.S., they announced that they are including Apple's new Fitness Plus subscription service in the lifetime memberships. So Lifetime is the name of the fitness gym. So their memberships, starting later this month, will include free Fitness Plus. So if you're already a member of that gym, you might already have access to this service. And also, United Healthcare is offering 5 months of Apple Fitness Plus for free to its members. Plus, after the 5 months, United Healthcare Motion users may be able to apply for program incentives to actually cover the monthly cost of Fitness Plus. So that might be another way you can get free access to Fitness Plus. I know if you bought an Apple Watch Series 6, Apple is also offering up 3 months of free service. I think there was a couple people who had experienced, or there were reports that some users were having a hard time signing up for the free 3 months. I got an email about mine, although I already had signed up for Apple Premier One, or Apple One Premier program, which actually includes Fitness Plus, so I'm actually already covered. But you should have received an email if you did purchase an Apple Watch Series 6 with information on how to sign up for your free 3 months of Apple Fitness Plus. And I think we talked about this on the last episode of the MacCast. According to Apple, Apple Fitness Plus does require that you have an Apple Watch. It's integrated with that, so it is a part of a requirement for the service. It's now that the service is out, what seems like it's going on is you do need an Apple Watch to set up and activate the service, but apparently you can do workouts on the iPhone or the iPad without an Apple Watch. If you don't have your Apple Watch with you or your Apple Watch isn't on and you try to start a workout from the fitness app on an iPhone or an iPad, what you will see is an option to work out without watch. You won't get the on-screen reporting and all the extra benefits of that, but you'll still be able to do your workouts. This is apparently not possible through the Apple TV, though, so it's a little unclear why the discrepancy between the two. Also, an interesting thing I heard is that if you do have an Apple Watch and you're someplace where they have an Apple TV, even if it isn't your Apple TV, and even if they do not have the Fitness Plus service, you can take your Apple Watch, put it near that Apple TV. It will automatically connect and allow you to actually do your workouts from that Apple TV. So if you're visiting someone, you can actually still do your workouts even though it's not your own Apple TV, which is kind of pretty cool. And that is actually something you might need to do, because one other small note about the Fitness Plus service is that it does not support AirPlay. So you can't, unfortunately, it looks like, start a workout from an iPhone or an iPad and then AirPlay it to a, say, smart television that supports AirPlay 2. You'll only get the audio, the video doesn't work. So there might still be a few little bugs and quirks for Apple to work out. It's not clear if that was intentional that AirPlay is not supported or if it's a bug. But hopefully it's just a bug, because, you know, if you're going to a hotel or you're traveling or something like that, once we can start sort of doing that again safely, it'd be nice not to have to carry an Apple TV around with you. And a lot of smart TVs now do have support for AirPlay 2. So Fitness Plus out and available now. You can check it out. And like I said, if you want to give us your opinions or a quick review, we would appreciate that. And while we're talking a little bit about Apple TVs, we are still hearing rumors that Apple is planning an update to the Apple TV sometime in 2021. We've been hearing this rumor for a while. It was thought it might happen last year. Well, this time around, Nikkei Asian Review is the latest source to claim that Apple is planning an Apple TV update sometime next year. Now, details continue to be sparse, but it is believed that Apple will add, of course, an updated processor. In the past, we've heard rumors that they would update to an A12 or maybe an A12X Bionic, and there was at least one source that claimed they were going all the way with an A14. Seems to me like they really probably do need to make a pretty quantum leap with the Apple TV, especially considering some of the new services like Apple Arcade and wanting to be able to maybe push games a little bit further for developers, and also just, you know, movies and those sorts of things, to be able to do more 4K, more with spatial audio. I think having that extra processing power is going to make a huge difference. So hopefully they go all the way with the latest modern processors. That seems to be the tack that they're taking, although Apple TV has always tended to lag a little bit behind. Also, rumors also claim that there might be some new storage sizes, up to 64 gigabytes and 128 gigabytes, and possibly that there will be a redesigned remote, which I know a lot of people will be very happy to hear about if that comes to fruition, because, man, the Apple TV remote, the Siri remote, gets a bad rap. I mean, even though Apple updated it with that little circle, it's still confusing. I mean, I pick mine up and have it the wrong way around all the time. So hopefully that's something Apple's designers are listening to, a complaint, and will ultimately address with the next generation of the Apple TV. And new storage sizes, more storage, again, I think that's important, especially considering what Apple's trying to do with Apple Arcade. There's also been some speculation that they may add a U1 ultra wideband chip. I think that makes sense because it could allow for some new cool handoff and continuity features, also just spatial awareness of other devices, say like your HomePods, those sorts of things. So all of that wrapped up could make a really nice new update for the Apple TV. It'd also be interesting, now that I'm thinking about it, to get a design change. I mean, we've had the black sort of square puck for a while. Maybe Apple could do something interesting and new with the design as well, although we haven't heard any rumors related to that. So I'm not, you know, I'm not going to say that they are going to do that. I'm just speculating that it might be cool to see a little bit of a redesign on the Apple TV. But looking like we might get something with Apple TV in 2021. I'm hoping that it comes earlier in the cycle rather than later. Apple is reportedly ramping up iPhone production. Again, this is coming from Nikkei Asian Review. They claim that iPhone 12 sales are going very well, and that because of that, Apple is planning to ramp up production, iPhone production overall, moving into the new year. They say by 30% in the first quarter of next year, which would be 30% over the same period last year, with Apple planning to produce up to 96 million iPhones in the first half of 2021. And this would be across all lines, including the iPhone 12s and even the older iPhone 11 and iPhone SE models. The report says that overall, Apple may be looking to produce about 230 million iPhones in 2021, and that would be up about 20% from the number of iPhones produced in 2019. Now, one supplier commented on demand, claiming that the demand for the iPhone 12 Pro models has been stronger than expected, while the iPhone 12 demand has basically met Apple's expectations. And surprisingly, the iPhone 12 mini demand has been a little less than they expected. So I wonder if on the lower end, more folks are opting to go with the older models like the iPhone 11 and the iPhone SE versus the iPhone 12 mini, maybe to save a little bit on cost. Maybe it's just the price differential. I personally would have thought the iPhone 12 mini would have been in pretty high demand, just based on responses and comments I have received over the years from our community. A lot of folks wanted a smaller model iPhone that had more of the modern tech that Apple was building into its devices. And the iPhone 12 mini seems to fit that bill, but maybe it's just not responding with consumers as well as Apple had hoped. So regardless, it looks like overall iPhone this year is doing very, very well. It's kind of on what they would call a super cycle. It remains to be seen how popular the iPhone 13 models will be, because again, iPhone 12, the big deal is the 5G, right? First phones with 5G technology from Apple. So that is going to get a lot more people to, I think, jump on board. And of course, the iPhone 13 is probably not going to have as many new features or enhancements. Of course, we're going to have to wait and see. But right now, it's looking like Apple is prepping for a pretty good first half of 2021, at least when it comes to the iPhone. If you've been on the App Store recently, you may have noticed that Apple did roll out their new privacy, quote-unquote, nutrition labels that they talked about and announced at Worldwide Developer Conference last year. They're now on display in the App Store. They're designed to make it much easier to understand the kinds of data that apps are collecting, and they show exactly how those apps are using it. And if you've seen these, I have to tell you, it's pretty shocking and maybe a little bit scary to see what apps are collecting, what bits of information. Sometimes confusing when you're looking at individual apps about, hey, why does this app need my address? Or like a couple of mine, it's like, why do they need my financial information? Or why are they grabbing that? And even more scary, why are they sharing that with third parties? And despite it being a little bit scary, I love the transparency. I think it's really great to see that level of clarity so that we as consumers can make really informed decisions about how we want to share our data information, how we want to keep control of our data, and we can decide, hey, you know, it's not worth it for me to use this freemium app if they're going to be this callous or open with my data and information. And we can make smarter, more informed choices. Or maybe you decide, hey, I'm totally fine with this in exchange for being able to get an app for free or an ad-supported app. I'm going to continue to use this. If you want to be really freaked out, look at some of your social media applications and see what they're doing. I mean, Facebook, Instagram, it's like a running list that goes on and on and on. You'll be scrolling for a little bit. I actually shot a little video and shared it on my Twitter account because I was actually so shocked by how long Instagram's little nutrition label was. So definitely does expose this stuff. Now, all developers are required to provide this information to Apple and for their apps, and those that don't, or those that provide inaccurate or misleading information, could be subject to have their apps removed from the App Store, and I would imagine also potentially have their developer license revoked if they continue to abuse or mislead consumers. So Apple is pretty serious about this thing. They rolled it out, and I think it's a nice enhancement. I personally like it. I think it's a nice new feature. But as always, I'd love to hear your opinions on it. Shoot us some comments. Send us an email, maccast@gmail.com. Last time we talked about Apple's latest product, their one more thing for the year, the new AirPods Max. And now AirPods Max are starting to get in the hands of consumers and reviewers. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how those reviews are coming in. And they're coming in pretty positive, despite the high price tag. Now, a lot of people still commenting on the high price tag for Apple's AirPods Max. They're a little bit out of my price range, I have to say that. But most of the reviews are describing what is a luxury listening experience. They say they sound great. Almost all the reviews that I've been running across have given very high praise to the active noise cancellation and transparency mode. Some of them going so far as to say it's the best active noise cancellation out on the market, and that's pretty high praise because there's a lot of great noise canceling headphones out there. Reviewers also seem to be very happy with the fit and finish of the product. Of course, it's totally Apple quality, really well built, but they're also commenting on the fit in terms of how they just sit on your head and how comfortable they are. There were a lot of concerns because they are metal, they're pretty heavy headphones, that they might not be comfortable when you're wearing them. A lot of the reviews that I've read have said that's really not the case. They feel great. They feel very well balanced, although they do note that they are heavy. They say if you don't move your head around too much, you will kind of not notice they're there, or they'll kind of fade. But the minute you start to move your head, they have a little bit of weight, a little bit of momentum to them. So you definitely know that they're there, which is a little bit different versus some of the other headphones that are out on the market, even high-end ones that are mostly all made of plastic. So Apple has pulled off a pretty good feat here. One thing that every review that I've seen pretty much universally agrees on is that they all hate, and I don't use that word lightly, they all pretty much hate the smart case, the little Apple purse, the Apple bra, whatever you want to call it, not getting very good reviews. Although in a recent interview, Apple's design team, including Evans Hanke, who's Apple's VP of Industrial Design, Eugene Wang, an industrial designer at Apple, and Bob Borchers, VP of Product Marketing, defended the smart case. They claimed that the goal was to make a storage-efficient case, meaning basically a not bulky case that was easy to fit into a bag. And so they kind of pointed to some of the hard cases that come with other higher-end headphones as being, you know, overly bulky. And so they were trying to avoid that, supposedly. They explained how the case is cut from a single piece of material and then folded and fastened in a way to make it three-dimensional, and they were pretty proud of that design. And they also commented on the exposed headband, because a lot of reviews had been saying, hey, with that exposed headband, that's probably the most delicate part of the headphone. It's going to get damaged and it's not even in the case. So what's going on there? They said that's not going to be an issue because the headband is actually very strong, very durable. And they pointed to the fact that by not having it inside the case, it gives you a pretty easy way to grab the headphones and basically get them out of your bag. So it sounds like there was a lot of consideration to how these would go in and out of a bag. I don't know. They don't fold down very compact. They're still pretty bulky, but I guess a lot of this style headphone is pretty bulky, especially if you give it a big, you know, hard shell case or something like that. And I'm sure there's a lot of opportunities left for other third parties to develop cases, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of those, probably expensive cases as well to go along with your expensive headphones. Another concern that was sort of addressed was a lot of the reviews commenting on the lack of a power button and a lot of confusion over how the headphones go into their low power mode. A lot of early reviews were saying if you don't put them in the smart case, they don't go into low power mode, that they drain quickly. That turns out not to be the case. Real world testing of people getting these now have verified once you take them off your head, and even if you don't put them in the smart case, they drain very, very slowly. As a matter of fact, one review I saw noted that it was just 3% battery drain over 10 hours without even being in the smart case. And that's because Apple came out with some additional information and clarification, noting that once you take them off your head and you're not using them, they will go into low power mode in about 5 minutes. And then after 72 hours of not being in the smart case and not being moved, they go into an ultra low power state that disables the Bluetooth and the Find My feature. Now, same thing in the smart case. You slide them in there, it goes instantly into low power mode. And then after 18 hours, it will go into that ultra low power state. So either way, it will get into low power mode, so you don't have to worry about that. And battery life does seem to live up to Apple's claims of 15 to 20 hours of listening. So that has held true, at least in the early reviews. We also got an iFixit teardown, or at least the start of a teardown. So they made some comments about the AirPods Max. They noted that, yep, there's a lot of glue. They're not easy to take apart. Really not surprising for an Apple product. The other thing they discovered was that there are two battery cells, but they're both in the same ear cup. So that's interesting. And the batteries don't seem to be easily replaceable. It does look like they are soldered in, but they're continuing to work on their teardown. So I'm sure we'll get more information about how the AirPods Max tick and what goes into making them when they complete their review. And then finally, in the headphone area, Korea's The Elec is reporting that Apple is planning to release an updated version of, or rather new versions of, AirPods Pro, AirPods Pro Lite in 2021. They say they would be exactly like the current AirPods Pros, but without the active noise cancellation, and they would be selling for US $200. So a little bit less expensive, not having the active noise cancellation. And this is a rumor we heard going into or back in 2020. So nothing really new here, just that we might see these new AirPods Pro Lites in 2021. I would presume that they would replace the lower cost AirPods that Apple has, or the lower cost AirPods will get even cheaper. In the same report, they also claim that AirPods Pros will get a redesign next year with a design that aims to get rid of the stems, to make them a little bit more compact and kind of match some of the other wireless Bluetooth headphones that have been released on the market recently. I think that's great if they can pull that off and still maintain the same audio quality for voice calls. And one thing that's nice about the stems, right, is that they've got those directional microphones. Although I guess we have those in HomePods as well, and those don't have little stems or anything pointed at our mouths. And Apple's done a pretty good job with those beamforming mics. So hopefully they can pull the same thing off with a redesigned set of AirPods Pros. And those will be very interesting to see. Probably a lot more compact in terms of the case and those sorts of things. So that's what's happening with Apple headphones. Apple Maps got some updates this week, specifically with some new cities in the U.S. getting the look around feature. You'll now be able to use Apple's look around, which is their street view style viewing in Apple Maps, in Denver, Colorado, Detroit, Michigan, Miami, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So the service look around is now available in 22 cities and regions around the world. I am still frustrated that it's not in San Diego yet. I know I'm biased and, you know, first world problems and all those sorts of things. But man, we're a pretty big market. I've seen their cars driving around here. When is it coming to my town? I'm sure you're saying the same thing, whatever town you live in, if you don't live in one of the 22 cities and regions where it's been rolled out already. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at Look Around, dive into one of these cities like Denver, Detroit, or Miami, and just drop a pin and look at it. It is amazing. Apple's Street View, Look Around, is just so much better than anything that Google has at this point. In my opinion, I think it's fabulous, and I can't wait to get it in my city. But looks like Apple is, you know, working on bringing this to other regions. We know a couple weeks back they brought it to some cities in Canada. They also rolled out their enhanced map features in Canada, which is great. That's another thing. Like, I know there's a lot of you out there that are saying, when am I just going to get enhanced maps? That's been rolled out in the U.S. It's been rolled out in Canada and in a few other countries. That is amazing as well. Really nice update to Apple Maps. And Apple just continues to work on this. As a matter of fact, LiDAR-equipped Apple Maps vehicles are now out surveying some new regions in Israel, New Zealand, and Singapore going through early 2021. So we would expect Apple to be rolling out maybe some of the Street View or look around features to those countries. And previously, they'd been, you know, roaming around parts of Australia, Belgium, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, Slovenia, and Croatia. So any one of these countries could get some new cities with look around sometime in 2021. Probably some of the new enhanced map features as well. Apple working very, very hard to, you know, really improve Apple Maps. And I think, at least in the U.S., I'd love to know about other countries, it's gotten a lot better. Apple Maps just continues to really improve and improve. And I think it's really because Apple's put these efforts with their cars and their ground truth folks. Another nice feature that I used recently, I'll just do a side comment on this, is if you're in Apple Maps and you want to update or add a location that doesn't exist, they have a button in the sharing tab that you can hit to report an error or a location. And I reported one recently, and literally within days I heard back and they said, yep, it's been corrected. It basically was a new restaurant that had gone in that they didn't have in Apple Maps yet it was in Google Maps. And I just reported it, gave them the information, and within days they had it already updated. I'm sure they verified my report and recognized that it was accurate, and then just added it to Apple Maps. So you can help contribute to Apple Maps through the Maps app itself and help improve maybe information in your region that isn't quite correct. And that wasn't the case a little while back. I know you could report stuff, but it would take months, if not longer, for Apple to actually update things. And I think they're more on top of it now. So this is really good stuff. Always good to see Apple Maps continuing to improve. And then a little bit of bad news here at the end of the news segment. Unfortunately, you know, the global pandemic continues to kind of rage on. We've seen some new resurgences in a number of areas. I live in California. That's one of the regions being affected. And because of that, Apple is taking precautions for retail customers and their retail employees. They've decided to close about 100 stores in various regions due to rises in COVID cases. This includes all retail stores in California and Tennessee, which are now closed indefinitely. Indefinitely just meaning until, you know, things calm down. They're not closed permanently. It just, they don't have a scheduled time. They don't know when they're going to actually reopen. There have also been closings of any UK stores that are under their new Tier 4 restrictions. And earlier in the week, they had closed 18 of their stores across Germany and the Netherlands. So a lot of Apple retail stores, unfortunately, closed at this moment. Most of the remaining open stores, at least here in the US, I don't know how it is internationally, are operating as or in their express capacity, meaning that Apple is basically allowing pickups and Genius Bar appointments, but really not any in-store shopping or browsing. They will let you in there. All stores are requiring face masks, limiting the store occupancy, mainly for Genius Bar appointments. They conduct temperature checks. They're implementing social distancing measures and doing regular deep cleanings of the stores. And so I went in a few weeks back to get a MacBook Pro serviced at the Genius Bar, and they definitely took my temperature. They were having everybody wait outside the store. They were really controlling things. Obviously, now they're closed here in California, but I do know they're open in other regions, mostly, again, for just in-store pickups and those sorts of things. So, unfortunately, you know, you hate to hear that. Retail employees obviously probably rely on Apple, although I think they're taking care of those folks. I hope so. At least early reports were that they were doing that. And hopefully, you know, things will calm down with these new restrictions. We'll get back on track. We'll lower the numbers and people can get back to work and we can get back into Apple retail stores sometime soon. Although, you know, the longer it lingers, it looks like it's going to be still a little while, unfortunately. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another couple show sponsors, starting with Fundrise. We've heard for years that it's important to have a diversified portfolio, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, that kind of thing. But if you've ever looked at a breakdown of the most successful portfolios, you'll typically see a diversified set of real estate. So why isn't it one of the first asset classes you consider when you're looking to diversify? Well, it's pretty simple, because it hasn't been available to investors like you and me until now, thanks to Fundrise. They make it easy for all investors to diversify by building you a portfolio of institutional quality real estate investments. So whether you're just starting to invest in real estate or looking to add more, our friends at Fundrise have you covered, and here's how. Fundrise is an investing platform that makes investing in high quality, high potential real estate as easy as investing in your favorite stocks and mutual funds. Whether you're looking to add stable cash flow via dividends or prefer long-term growth through appreciation, Fundrise has you covered. To date, Fundrise manages more than $1 billion in assets for 130,000 plus investors. And since 2014, the Fundrise platform has averaged 8.7 to 12.4% annual returns, and investors have earned more than $79 million in dividends alone. Fundrise's team of real estate professionals carefully vets and actively manages all of their real estate projects, and with their easy-to-use website, you can track your portfolio's performance and watch as properties across the country are acquired, improved, and operated via asset updates. Signing up only takes a few minutes, and there's no complicated paperwork. Start building your better portfolio today. Get started at fundrise.com/maccast to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. That's fundrise.com/maccast to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. fundrise.com/maccast. And a big thank you to Fundrise for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank sponsor MacPaw for their support of the MacCast, and I want to talk to you about their product, Clean My Mac X. Clean My Mac X is an all-in-one cleaning and optimization software for your Mac. It is something that I use all the time on a regular basis. I actually have been receiving a lot of questions lately about how I keep my Mac cleaned and up to date and just running efficiently. And really the answer is Clean My Mac X. I've been using it for years, long before they were ever a sponsor on the show. It just has a ton of great, useful features and functionality. It helps you stay aware of where all your apps are and where they're installed. You can get information on all of the apps and their permissions. You can find out which programs have access to different functionality on your Mac. So if you want to know what you've given permissions to for your camera and your microphone, they can do that. One of the most powerful and popular features is the Smart Scan feature. This is going to examine your system for all that cruft that can build up, things like log files and user caches, and it can clear all that stuff out. It can also do a quick malware scan, so you can make sure you don't have any nasties on there. You can run optimization tasks to help speed up your Mac, and it does it all very efficiently and very quickly. You can use it to find large files and clean those things out. So it has lots of optimization capabilities. It can find tasks that are running in the background and using up your processes. And I think it does it better, in my opinion, than even the built-in activity monitor, which can be a little bit confusing. It just goes on and on, the list of things. Oh, the uninstaller. A lot of you have been asking me about how do you uninstall apps and make sure you get all the little bits and pieces that might be in your user's library folder. So the application support folder and the preferences folder. Clean My Mac X is the thing to use for that. You can just go in, find the application in the list, say uninstall, and it will uninstall the entire thing. Much better than just dragging it to the trash, which is how Apple would have you uninstall it, because doing that leaves all that stuff behind. So Clean My Mac 10 gives you more control over your apps and files. You can find out where those programs are, and you can get those cleaned off. And it's totally compatible now with Big Sur. Has a redesigned icon, has a new widget that lets you check for the space on your Mac and see trends over time. It is awesome stuff. You can learn more about Clean My Mac X and download it for free by going to macpaw.app/maccast. That's macpaw.app/maccast to check out Clean My Mac X from MacPaw and do it now. You're gonna be happy you did. And a big thank you to MacPaw and Clean My Mac X for their support of the MacCast. Last week on the MacCast, I had a question from a listener who was running out of space on the internal drive on his iMac. And he was asking about moving his photo library, which was fairly large, over to an external drive. And we talked about that a little bit. And specifically, there was a question about what kind of drive do I need to get? Do I need to get an SSD? Should I get a Thunderbolt drive? Is a USB 3 drive okay? Is a spinning drive okay? And I kind of shared my thoughts and opinions on it. And ultimately, what my conclusion was that it wouldn't probably matter too much. I have a Mac that I've used with an external photos library that's just using a USB 3 hard drive, and we haven't had really too many issues with it. Now, is it the fastest thing on the planet? No, but cost to performance, you know, there's some trade-offs, and SSDs, as awesome as they are, can tend to be a little bit pricey, or more pricey than that kind of drive. So, you know, I kind of erred on the side of maybe save a little bit of money, maybe deal with a little less performance, but you're probably going to be okay and the experience is going to be fine. And more what it was about was trying to, you know, get that storage space back and be able to not have to run the Photos app in the optimized mode, which means you don't have a local copy. You know that most of your photos in iCloud Photo Library are stored up in the cloud, and you don't have that local copy that you can back up. So, you know, really trying to help that listener get those photos stored locally and do that without breaking the bank. Well, as you might imagine, I asked the community for their thoughts and opinions, and many of you did just that. And I'm so glad you did, because, you know, you have, a lot of you have a contrary opinion to what I said, and I don't disagree at all. Many of you wrote in to say, no, that's bad advice. You really do, you know, especially with photos and the Photos app and a large photo library, you're going to want an SSD because you're accessing that in real time. You're doing a lot of reading and writing, especially if you're doing editing, but even just opening up a large photo library, you know, you can feel that performance. And I know, I'll admit, with a traditional spinning drive, a USB-C or a USB 3 drive, yeah, you are going to experience some of that. But like I said, it's going to be at the trade-off of probably saving quite a bit of money on that external drive, especially considering that I believe this listener wanted about a 2 terabyte drive. And if you go price 2 terabyte SSD drives, yeah, they're coming down in cost, but you're looking at, I would imagine, $300, $400, somewhere in that range for that amount of storage. At least when I was doing my looking for something that is, you know, good quality, good performance. You might be able to save a little bit of money if you build the drive yourself, so you get an enclosure and then just buy a internal SSD. You might be able to get that cost down a little bit more, maybe $200, $300 range. But still, that's quite a bit of money to invest. But I guess if you have a large photo library, maybe that's okay. And so, you know, I would say I totally agree. If you want the best performance, if you're going to be having an external drive that you're having to actively work off of, and you need fast performance, you're going to want to get the fastest drive you can get, which means an SSD drive. You're also going to want to get the fastest interface that you can get, because you have to think about not just the speed of the drive, but really the throughput. How much reading and writing, what performance can you get through your interface? And that probably means going with, if you have USB-C or USB 3.1 Generation 2, you want to get that. So that's, 10 megabits per second, I think, speed, or even better than that, do Thunderbolt 3 and an SSD where you can get up to 40 gigabits per second through the interface. If you go with something like USB 3.1 Generation 1, you're only going to get about 5 gigabits per second, I think, is the transfer rate. So your interface might be your bottleneck depending upon what you're trying to do. And so a number of you pointed out, hey, that's something you really need to think about too when you're looking at that. So again, I think this ends up kind of being a balance. It ends up being, what trade-offs are you willing to take to maybe save some money? So, you know, in theory, it sounds great. Get a Thunderbolt SSD, a super fast one. It's going to be awesome. Performance is going to be barely noticeable or different from maybe what your internal drive is doing. And again, I 100% agree with that. But budget might not allow for that, and you might have to make some trade-offs. I mean, ultimately, the best place to store those files is going to be on your internal drive. Unfortunately, a lot of modern Macs don't have the option to upgrade the internal storage anymore. That would used to be the answer, would be, oh, just update your SSD, get a bigger one, you know, get a bigger drive and put that in your Mac. If you're on an older Mac, you might have that option, and that's definitely a great way to go. But, you know, in the case of photos, yeah, it probably is worth, you know, and I appreciate the community kind of correcting me on this. It probably is worth spending the extra money if you can to get a external SSD drive and something with a faster interface like USB-C, USB 3, 1.2 Generation 2, Thunderbolt, that sort of thing. And that's probably going to pay off in the long run. You know, also, if you're getting an external drive for anything where you're going to be actively working off that drive, video editing or Photoshop or any of those sorts of things, you want the fastest connection. You want the fastest drive that you can get. My only point was, if you can't afford that, going the other route, yeah, it's not going to be the end of the world. You might be dealing with a little bit of waiting and some beach balls. Many of you pointed out that if you have a very large library, you might be waiting for a very long time, so it might not be worth it. So you may want to do some testing just to double check and make sure that, you know, you're going to be happy with that. To that end, I did get a really great tip from Maccaster Nacho of a possible good compromise to the situation that our friend had on the last episode of the Maccast, which is, he says, you know, I use my iCloud photo library and the internal drive on my Mac using the optimize storage option. So this is the thing where you can put photos in a mode where it will keep the files in iCloud and then just download stuff when you access it to your Mac. Again, the problem with that we talked about on the last episode of the Maccast is it means you don't have a local copy of all your photos. You're kind of trusting all your photos to Apple and the iCloud photo library. Not something that I'm personally comfortable with, but some people might. Well, what Nacho said is what he does then is he has an external spinning drive. It might not be the fastest performing thing, but he sets up a second user account on his Mac. And then in that user account for the photo library, he has it set up to use the external USB 3 drive. And in the settings, he sets that account to use the, you know, copy all the photos locally option. So it'll copy all the photos to that external drive, but he's really only using that to get a local backup. So when he's working day to day, he's working off his fast internal SSD drive. And then about once a week or so, he just logs into that secondary account and opens up photos and gives it the time to sync all of the more recent photos or updated photos locally to that external drive. And that way you have a local backup, but then day to day, you're just working efficiently off of that internal drive, and you're getting the speed benefit of that internal drive, and you're operating your iCloud photo library in the optimized photos mode, or optimized storage mode, I think is what Apple calls it. So I thought that was a great tip and a great trade-off, a great way to potentially handle this. The caveat, of course, meaning that you got to make sure that you're logging into that other account, which is a little bit of a hassle, but hey, it kind of gives you the best of both worlds. You can get some cheap external storage to make sure that you back up all of your photos locally, and day in and day out, you can be operating and working with a faster photo library on your internal drive, on your internal SSD, without taking up all that extra storage space. So that might be a way to save a little bit of money, not have to get an external SSD, and still be able to roll forward with your large photo library. So a great tip, Nacho, and thank you for sending that in. All of this did kick off another question, though, that came up from another listener, just in general, about using external drives to supplement the storage on our Macs. So we have all this stuff, right? Our applications folder that can fill up, our photo libraries that can get large, our media libraries that can get very large. And so then the question comes, when we start to run out of space on our internal drives, what can we do with externals? Do we get, you know, external old school SSDs with a lot of storage at a very cheap price? Do we get faster SSDs? What about NAS drives, you know, network attached storage, or RAIDs? Do I get a multi-disk drive and connect that locally, something like a Drobo or a Synology? And that's a very complex topic. And a lot of solutions, I think, are going to vary by your specific needs. But I think we can have a conversation about some generalized recommendations. And I'll tell you how I think about it. Again, not the be-all, end-all. This is just, you know, me kind of spitballing and thinking through this. and you might have different opinions. So if you do, you know, please email me, send me an audio comment. I'd love to hear from you if you think a little bit differently about this. But I just thought in general, this is sort of, you know, how I think about different kinds of applications or needs for external storage and the solutions that I might apply for those situations. So, you know, internal SSD storage, always going to be the best possible performance. And this is where when you're buying a new Mac, you're going to want to think about this, right? Buy the largest and most amount of storage that you can afford, that you can buy. And I almost think these days, with a few exceptions, that if you're having to make a trade-off between RAM, so say you're thinking about, do I get that 8 gigs of RAM or that 16 gigs of RAM or that 32 or 64? And again, this is for generalized applications. You know, obviously, if you're doing high-end Photoshop work or you're doing really high-end video editing or something like that, RAM is going to be very important. But storage is also going to be very important to you. So you probably have to pay for both. But I'm talking about the folks that email me on a regular basis and say, you know, I am doing mostly Word. I'm working in Apple's basic applications like Photos and those sorts of things. I'm doing maybe light Photoshop work, but nothing really heavy. You know, you are probably going to want to have a fair amount of good local storage. And I would almost argue that if you're making that trade-off between 8 and 16 gigabytes of RAM versus getting, you know, 512 gigabytes of storage or a terabyte of storage over 256, I would almost go for the storage because Apple's operating system also does a pretty good job of using swap if you start to run out of storage. And if you have a lot of extra fast SSD storage, it's going to be a little less of an impact. Is it going to be as ideal as having that extra RAM? No. You know, if you can afford both, get both. But I'm more of the mind that you probably want to invest in the storage, then the RAM. And that would just be my preferred order, again, for these more generalized applications. So get as much as you can. You're going to want all your working files and apps to be local. So you really don't want to be installing apps or, you know, daily working files onto external drives if you can afford it. Again, we'll talk about kind of the exception for this, which is going to be external SSDs and media libraries. You know, your photo library, your audio video libraries, those would be great if they could be on your internal storage as well. It's always going to be your fastest storage because of the interface and where it is. Now, if you just can't do that, you're running out of storage, or you just have storage needs that go beyond that, you're going to work with external storage. You know, the two things you're going to want to think about is the interface. You're going to want fast interfaces. Always use the fastest interface possible. So USB 3.1 Generation 2 or Thunderbolt are kind of the fastest interface options we have today. Thunderbolt is going to be the fastest, followed by the USB, although, you know, some of the USB, like USB 4 that's coming around, is getting quicker. And, you know, you just really need to pay attention to where your bottleneck is. And usually it's going to be that external interface. Once you go external, you know, it's not going to be anywhere near as fast as your internal performance. So you're going to want to focus on that interface. You're also going to want to focus on probably using SSDs if you're using local drives, and probably the newer U.2 drives, if you can. You know, SSD technology is changing all the time. So just think speed. You're going to want to look at throughput. You're going to want to look at the read-write speeds and get the fastest that you can afford, and that will match your interface. Obviously, you're not going to want to get an SSD that has performance well beyond or well above what your interface can handle, because then you're just spending money to spend money, I guess. You know, if the drive is going really fast, but you can't push it through to your machine as fast, it's really not worth it. So, you know, avoid that situation. And when you're looking at multi-drive solutions, so if you're looking at an external RAID, something like that, you're going to want probably an SSD RAID. You're also going to want a fast RAID for, and again, this is when you're talking about I'm going to move my files to an external device, and I'm going to be working off of that external device. We're going to talk about the other situation in a minute, which is more archive and backup. But I am talking right now about fast external working storage. And so if you're doing a RAID or a multi-disk drive, you're going to want to RAID it up as something like RAID 0, which is generally what we call scary RAID. It's not any redundancy. It's not any backup protection. It's just going to be ultra-fast storage. You're going to want to use SSDs if possible. If you absolutely have to use spinning drives, you're going to want fast, high-performance spinning drives. So it's not going to be cheap, right? You're going to have to spend some money if that's your need. And we're talking about things like, again, video editing, large photo editing with Photoshop or even photos, those sort of things. If those are your needs, this is the kind of storage and interfaces that you're going to need to think about. And then you have kind of, I guess, the last kind of external storage, which is more just, you know, archive and backup. So this is, you know, I just have files. They're building up on my machine. I need to store them somewhere. I'm not going to have to access them very frequently. I'm not going to open them up off of my external drive and work off of them. What I would do is if I need those files back, I would copy them back onto my external drive. You know, so this is just a place to stick all of your data and store it safely and securely in a place where you can easily access it and get it back. And it also includes just backups if you just want to do backups. And here's where I really think you can still get away with, you know, a USB 3 interface. Again, it's going to depend, and I'm going to caveat this, it's going to depend on how frequently you need to read and write from that drive, right? If you're constantly having to move things back and forth and access that stuff, then you're probably going to want a faster interface, a faster drive technology. But if it's just archival, hey, I need to get these off of my internal drive because, you know, it's a project folder. I'm done with that project. I'm just going to store it over here. I might need it back a month or two from now. Throw it over there. You're only going to copy it over once. You know, you can wait. If it takes a little bit longer, takes a few minutes longer to copy over there, get a USB 3 drive. You know, it probably can be a Gen 1 3, you know, USB 3.1 Gen 1. It doesn't have to be the fastest. And you could use a spinning hard drive, or you could use just a network attached storage device, or maybe a multi-bay drive that just has some spinning hard drives in it, right? Something like a Drobo. And you're probably going to be fine with that. So that's kind of how I think about different levels of storage and working with media and getting more storage on my Mac. And for me, most of my work falls in that last category. My MacBook Pro, I have a 1 terabyte drive on my internal drive, and it serves me just fine. I probably run it about 60 to 70% full most of the time. And when it starts to fill up, I clean stuff off. I archive it off onto external USB drives, onto a Drobo that I have attached to this system, and that works for me. I also have some NAS drives on my network that I can copy things to. I have a lot of options, but I generally don't, with my main Mac, work off of external drives. If I did, I'd be investing in things like SSDs and probably Thunderbolt SSDs, which, again, are expensive. It's an expensive way to go, but unfortunately, that's what Apple has left us with by limiting the amount of internal storage we can get on a lot of our Macs these days. You know, I hope it continues to get better. It seems to have continued to get better. We do have larger storage options now, right? We can get up to, like, what is it, 4 terabytes in most cases. But again, you're going to pay for it. And you will want to think about doing that up front if those are your needs. If you have high storage needs and you need immediate access to working files, you're going to want as much internal storage on your Mac as you can possibly afford. So just think about all these things. So in summary, you know, keep working files and applications and all that stuff locally if you can. If you can't and you need to have stuff that's available on external drives, but you need to work off of those, get the best performance, best interface that you possibly can. And then for archival stuff, you can go a little bit cheaper, you can go a little bit slower, and it's not really going to impact you. So that's my general advice. I'm sure some of you might have more specific questions. If you do, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. And of course, if you have other advice, if you disagree with me, agree with me, I'd love to hear from you. Send in those comments and emails as well. So kind of while we're on this topic, another thing that came up recently was I talked about a old Mac Mini that I have. It is a 2006 Mac Mini. It's an Intel Core Duo machine. It runs Mac OS Snow Leopard because that's the most modern operating system that it can run. And it is a machine that sits on my network, and I use it as a backup solution. It's connected to an old original 4-bay FireWire Drobo. I think it's a FireWire 800, if I'm remembering the interface correctly. I mentioned that basically I had the drive in that Mac Mini fail. And I swapped it out with just an extra drive that I had around because I wanted to get it back up and running because it's served me very, very well as a network backup drive. And David emailed me and said, hey, you know, I have some old Macs lying around. I love this idea of repurposing an old Mac as a network attached storage device. Can you kind of walk me through how you have yours set up and what you're doing with it? And I'll just caveat this by saying, you know, I use it in kind of a very specific way. And it may work for some of you. It may not be the thing you need. There are lots of options. There's lots of ways to set this up. But he asked, so I'm going to go ahead and describe what I have. I think I've done this in the past, but it's been a really long time. So I'll catch everybody up. So here's what's going on. I already mentioned it's a 2006 Mac Mini. I have it connected to my network over just Wi-Fi. I don't even have it hardwired, although I guess I could do that if I wanted to run some cables. I did sort of upgrade the airport in it using an external USB Wi-Fi adapter. I use a Bear Extender Turbo 802.11ac adapter from Bear Wi-Fi or Bear-Fi. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com, but that's just really so I can have a faster connectivity to it over my Wi-Fi network. It is running Snow Leopard, and then within the operating system, I just have turned on the file sharing so that I can mount it as a network drive over my network, and I have screen sharing turned on because I run it headless, so I can't, there's no monitor or keyboard or anything connected to it. It's just sitting there on my network, and then I access it remotely using the built-in screen sharing in Mac OS, and then I can log into it. I can work with it. So that works out very well. And I just turn that on through the sharing in the system preferences. And then really, the only other thing that's installed on that is the Drobo dashboard software, because like I said, I have it connected to this old FireWire Drobo that I use for the actual storage portion. And the other application that I have running on it is Chrono Agent, which is a companion app for ChronoSync, and it just allows the software to have better connectivity, better access for the ChronoSync software. And I'll talk about ChronoSync and what I use that for here in a second. So that's kind of the setup for the Mac Mini sitting on my network. So it's just connected to my network. Any of my Macs can access it through the file sharing or through the Chrono Agent. And really, Chrono Agent is how I access it, because on my MacBook Pro, I use ChronoSync, which is a backup and synchronization application, from Econ Technologies, which is amazing. And what's amazing about ChronoSync is just all the different ways that you can set up and use it. You can use it to sync entire volumes, folders. You can use it for backups. You can create bootable backups from it. It just really is an amazing, versatile application. And the way I specifically use it is I have a number of different synchronizations set up. So the whole point of my Mac Mini backup storage solution is to do what I call archival storage. So I have my standard backups that I do. As you know, I do Time Machine backups. I do Carbon Copy Cloner, bootable backups of my entire system and volume and stuff like that. But then I have specific folders on my Mac, like my Documents folder, the folder I use for the MacCast, my Media Library, my iMovie folder that I have my iMovie projects in. I have client folders for my web development work. These are all specific folders that files flow through day in and day out, right? So I might be working on a project for a client in my client's folder, haven't done a lot of work for client for that client in years, and I need to clean up space on my Mac. I want to be able to delete a client folder, but not lose the data, not lose the content. Of course, I have it in some of my backups, but the minute that I delete it from my local Mac, eventually that's going to sync up and that'll get deleted, say, from my Time Machine library. So I do want to have like an archive of that where, you know, 10 years from now, if I wanted to go back and get those files back, I could. And that's where this ChronoSync solution comes in. Because what ChronoSync allows me to do is set up these different synchronizations for these folders, and it has this really cool feature where you can tell it not to sync deleted files. So all of these different synchronizations I set up as a one-way sync, so it copies any files that don't exist on the Drobo from the folder that's on my Mac over my network through ChronoSync, through the Chrono agent, to the Drobo. So my entire Documents folder, for example, or my entire MacCast folder. So you would imagine when I'm working on the MacCast, each episode I set up a folder for, and I have a number of files. I have my my GarageBand files. I have different audio files for audio clips that people send in, the intro, outro, all that stuff. And it's all in a single folder, MacCast folder, and then I have a subfolder for each episode. And so what ChronoSync does, for example, the ChronoSync that I have set up for backing up the MacCast to that Drobo on the Mac Mini, is I tell it, okay, take the MacCast folder that's on my local drive and sync it one way to the MacCast folder that is on the Drobo. And it will, anything that's in my local folder will get copied to over the network to the Drobo that's connected to the Mac Mini. And then because I have it set up to not sync deleted files, what can happen is at any moment, any old episode or any old working folder that I have locally, I can just go ahead and delete, knowing that the next time the sync runs, it's only going to add new things to the Drobo on the Mac Mini, and it's not going to delete anything that I deleted locally. So it's not a true sync. Now, ChronoSync you can set up so that I always want both folders to match exactly. So if I delete something here, delete something over there, and vice versa. I mean, you can set it up in a million ways. It's got all kinds of rules, scriptable. Again, it's a really powerful application. We don't have the time to go into all of the features, but this is sort of how I have mine set up. And then, so what happens is I set up all these ChronoSyncs. ChronoSync allows you to schedule them, so I have them running on schedules, different schedules depending upon what it is. So for like the MacCast folder, I think I have it run once or twice a day. I don't really remember. Other things like my Documents folder, I have it run a couple times a day. Same thing with like my client files folder, any folders that I'm sort of changing more frequently. And it just runs in the background. I don't even have to really think about it. It doesn't really affect my Mac. Now, the one thing that I do have to do is leave my Mac on. So, you know, I don't shut down my Mac at night. I leave it on. I have it go to display sleep. But then in the energy saver preferences, when it's hooked up to power, I have it set up to prevent sleeping automatically when the display is turned off. I also have it set up to wake for Wi-Fi access. And I also have enable power nap when plugged into a power adapter, turned off. So basically, the machine stays up and running in the background, the screen goes to sleep, and nothing else. And that way, it's up and available for ChronoSync to do all the things that it needs to do. So it's constantly running, it's constantly backing up and creating these backups. And that's how the system works. It's pretty straightforward, it's pretty easy to set up, and that's how I do it. Now, I bet you there's a number of you out there that have all kinds of different solutions and things that you're using older Macs for and maybe repurposing your Macs for. And I would love to just have a conversation here on the MacCast and in our community about all the ways that you can use old Macs to continue to, you know, work as daily work machines. And this is just one example. I know there's a lot out there. I can probably come up with a few more, but I'd love to hear from you. So please send me your emails and audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. If you have any questions about sort of what I talked about in my setup here, happy to answer those as well. You can send those along. And David, I hope this helps explain what I'm doing. I don't know if this is going to work for what you're thinking, but if you have a different thought or a different use case, if you want to share those details with us, we can maybe help you out with that as well. But hopefully you found this useful, and thank you for your question. Another thing that came up on the MacCast, I think last week, was some comments and a tip about Apple's Voice Memo app, which is a really cool app. It's a great way to record comments for the MacCast, and it has some really cool features. And Apple has been kind of tweaking it and advancing it recently. And I think one of the reasons they might be doing that is because you may or may not remember that there is another Memos app in Apple's audio sort of app library that it turns out might be going away sometime soon. And because of the audio comment on the last episode of the MacCast, I received this audio comment this week from Dan.
Hey, Adam, this is Dan from Oregon. And I heard your spot on the Voice Memos app just now. And I too have been using that a lot over the last few years, and had gone away from the Music Memos app that came out. It was kind of geared towards musicians. It's got some really cool features in it, but it's being discontinued, I read this week. So I thought I would just mention that in case there's other people like me who had used the Music Memos app. I'm a musician, so I had written a few songs in there. I had a bunch of audio clips, but it was a little finicky, a little glitchy sometimes, didn't sync quite right. Or something like that. So I had gone away from it and was using the Voice Memos app. And so if I hadn't read this little article I saw this week, I may not have opened up the Music Memos app for a long time, and it's going to not be developed anymore, I guess. So open up your Music Memos app if you've used that in the past and just hit the export button. They made it super simple, and then it just shoots your files over into the Voice Memos app, and it'll all be taken care of. So just thought I would mention that.
Hey, Dan, thank you for mentioning that, because I think I read that article as well, and I didn't even make the connection that, hey, if the app is going away, what's going to happen to those audio files, right? This is something we've talked about in other contexts here on the MacCast, specifically with what we call kind of bit rot, right? What happens when you have old file formats or old stuff stored in old formats that might be going away? Now, I would imagine the Music Memos app is just standard audio formats. Not sure what version. I would guess M4A, so Apple's AAC audio files probably, or I don't know, maybe they're a higher quality. Maybe there's some sort of Apple lossless format. Point is, though, even though it's standardized, you know, what happens to those files when the app goes away? How do you get those out? So good for folks to know that, hey, if you've ever used that app, if you have stuff stored in there, hey, you want to open up the app and export it out. Apple's moving that back over to the Voice Memos app. And it's cool to hear that they made that really easy to do. So thank you for sending that in and sharing that with the community, because I would not have thought to do that. And I'm sure there's other folks out there who probably hadn't thought to do that as well. So you may have saved a lot of people's work. And so we really do appreciate that. So thank you, Dan. All right. Last thing that I have for you this week is a thing of the moment. And this is something that I had talked about on previous episodes of the MacCast wanting to get. It's a product that I had been, well, I guess a product category really that I had been looking into for a very, very long time. And I finally broke down. I finally pulled the trigger and I bought a Thunderbolt 3 dock. And I do want to say thank you because I think I asked the community not long ago what docks you guys were using and enjoyed. And I got a lot of great feedback. Many people pointing to the OWC docks, many people pointing to, let's see, what were the other popular ones? The OWC Thunderbolt docks, Otherworld Computing, the Elgato product. Elgato makes some really nice docks as well. And there was, the CalDigit was probably the most popular one that a lot of folks pointed me to. And really one of the reasons I hadn't pulled the trigger on a Thunderbolt dock was just the cost. They tend to be pretty expensive, usually in the $250 to $300 range. And I finally broke down because one of my favorite companies I've talked about here on the MacCast is Anker. And Anker has a Thunderbolt 3 dock. And over the sort of Black Friday, Cyber Monday week stuff, they had theirs on special. So normally I think it's about $250 US. I was able to get a Black Friday deal on it for $189.99. So about $190 US. So saved about $50 on it. And ended up with the Anker Power Expand Elite 13-in-1 Thunderbolt 3 dock. And I am absolutely loving it. I finally have it. So my MacBook Pro, I plug in a single cable and I have all the connectivity I need. And that's quite a bit of connectivity because connected to this thing, I have my audio interface for doing my podcasting, which is a Zoom H4n that connects via USB. I also have my display, which is a mini DisplayPort display or a DisplayPort display connected via mini DisplayPort through a USB-C or really a Thunderbolt 3 adapter. I have my Drobo, which is connected through Thunderbolt as well. I also have five USB hard drives for all of my backups. There's one under here too. So I have, five USB hard drives for all my various backups, Time Machine, Carbon Copy Cloner, my media files, all those sorts of things. So a lot of connectivity, and I was having to use a lot of adapters and a lot of cables to plug that into my 16-inch MacBook Pro. I now have the one single Thunderbolt cable, USB-C cable, basically, and it is awesome. Love it. And, this Anker product provides 85 watts of charging power, so not quite the 97 that I was kind of holding out for. I think pluggable or somebody just came out finally with one that'll do a full 100 watts. But like I said, I got a good deal on this one, and it does have a lot of connectivity. Two Thunderbolt 3 40 gigabit per second ports, two USB-C Gen 2 ports, one with power delivery for fast charging and support, and those are on the front. The design is one of those stand-up sort of tower ones, very much like the CalDigit product. I like that it has a power button on it, so I can turn the power on and off on the front. It also has a 3.5-millimeter audio in-out jack and a USB-A port, along with the two USB-C ports and SD card slots, both a micro SD and a standard SD card slot. And then on the back, it has three additional USB-A ports. Those are 3.1 Gen 1 ports. So it has one on the front, three on the back. It also has HDMI 2.0 and gigabit Ethernet. And I think that's everything. So all of those ports, like I said, it's pretty nice. A few little complaints. The power supply is external, so the box itself is a fairly decent size. I would put it somewhere between a 2.5-inch hard drive and probably more toward a 3.5-inch hard drive size, but it does have a big power supply brick that is external because of that. And also, it came with a Thunderbolt 3 cable, which is really nice, not always something that would be included, but that cable was only 2.3 feet long, and I need something a little bit longer. So I did end up ordering a premium 2-meter Thunderbolt 3 USB-C cable from OWC at maxsales.com. That was about another $70 just to get that cable. And you do, if you're connecting Thunderbolt 3, you need the full capacity Thunderbolt 3 cable. Not all Thunderbolt 3 USB-C cables are created equal. So I think Apple makes one now that runs about $129. So I figured $70 was a pretty good deal. I'm waiting for that to come still, but once I have that all hooked up, I will be totally set. So I'm totally stoked and excited about this Anker Power Expand Elite 13-in-1 Thunderbolt 3 dock. And that's why this week it is the thing of the moment. Again, if you have other docks and hubs and things that you like, I always welcome thing of the moments from the community. You can send emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or find me on Instagram. I am MacCast on Instagram. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.